Hi, guys, and welcome to the 60th episode of Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. It's really nice to have you here. I'm flying solo again this week. We don't have Mo. Like we said in the last episode, he's really busy with this competition thing with the winter sports. But it's really a pleasure because we do have our second guest of 2021 with us today, and I'm really excited to introduce her. But first, right up front, I do want to say that if you have been listening to this show before, and if you're also new and you enjoy this episode, what really helps people find our show is if you go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and if there's a feature to give it a rating or a comment or to give it a share, anything like that, it really helps boost, for some reason, it really helps boost the algorithm, and it really helps new listeners find our show. So if you are a creative person, if you're an expat, anything like that, and you think someone that you know might enjoy the show, or you want to help share that to other people in your situation, that really helps new people find us. So please go do that. If you want to financially support the show, like I've mentioned before, we are getting into live streaming. We're going to get into video podcasting soon, and any donations, of course, all go towards that and really help a lot. And I thought I had one more thing I wanted to mention right at the top, but maybe it'll come to me later. Otherwise, guys, this is episode 60, and we have our guest with us today, a friend of mine, a very talented entertainer of all sorts, a musician, actress, improv, pianist, everything you can imagine under the sun, all in one. Welcome, Emma Holmes.
Hi there, Jordan. Nice to be on the show. Thank you for
inviting me. It's really great to finally have you on here because I remember we used to work together at this school, and I remember, I think it was over a year ago, or maybe it was about a year ago, I told you I wanted to get you on the show.
Well, you told me before you even started the podcast, you're like, hey, will you come on my show? I'm like, yeah, come on your show. And
was it before we even started recording?
Yeah, so you know. Oh, whatever, man. Dude.
Oh, that's really bad. That's really embarrassing.
Yeah. But you know, if I want you find at the bottom of the barrel you've been scraping.
No, not at all. Not at all. So I remember there was even it's kind of a sweet symphony in a way that there was this one day you were teaching a class and you asked me to come in to talk to your despondent teenagers about podcasts. Do you remember that?
They were only despondent in other people's lessons, but yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
So what are all the lessons and what are all the things that you teach at the school?
Wow. All sorts of things.
Because I want to talk about that first, and then I want to get into like all the creative stuff that you do, because that's a much bigger conversation.
Yeah, although I do think that my day job allows me to be incredibly creative as well, so it's not completely off topic in that sense. I teach French and English, mostly English, not as a foreign language, but as you would learn it in the UK or the US or Canada, wherever you have English as a native language. Yeah. And mixed in with that, I also am responsible for the school production, which we've only done one so far because COVID, alas, put a stop to last year's and probably this year's as well. And I also teach part of the Abitur. I teach English at Abitur level, but as part of the Abitur, I also do a peer seminar, which is part of it. It's a project, basically, the kids have to do. And the number of topics, you know, are endless. That could be about anything. And I chose to do, I've chosen the last 2 years to do improv theatre. I've pitched a new one for next year about the human voice and experimenting with the human voice and making music using that.
Oh, wow.
So all sorts of stuff, really. It's not just the academics.
So the first production that you did at the school, this play Peter Pan, was that that was the very first one that you did?
It was the first one that was done at Forums, yeah.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say because it was so seamless, it felt like that couldn't have been the first one that you were streamlining.
Well, I did the same play. I mean, it was one that I didn't write Peter Pan, my God, I would never claim that, of course, but we adapted the story. A colleague of mine that I used to work with in the UK, she sort of did the main part of the text, the script, adapted from the novel, of course, and then I did the music for that. And I'd done that back in the UK in 99. No, that's rubbish. Sorry. I'm 99. That's when I left school. 2009 it was. Yeah. Cause I left the UK in 2010. That's right. I did start writing some of the songs all the way back in 99.
For Peter Pan.
Yeah. Because, school, it was a British school and we had houses, like at Hogwarts, and every year we had to put on a play in our house, and one year the theme was fairy tales and we had Peter Pan. So two of the songs that were in the final production that you saw were also written when I was still at school.
That's unbelievable that you held on to them that long. That's really cool.
Well, I'd always wanted to make more of it, you know, and then that came then later on when I was teaching.
I guess writing music for a production like that does make more sense that they last long over time. They get better over time and they aren't something that you can easily throw away as opposed to when you write your own music. Mm. Like I mentioned with my own songs, I'm you know, I write a few ideas down and then maybe 1% of them gets through to something that I keep and finally, you know, arrange and record and like spend time promoting and trying to tour. But the other 99% of what's in these scattered notebooks, like maybe I'll take a lyric or a chunk for something in the future, but the rest, it really ends up just going into the ether. Like I just never think about it again. But
because it comes down, a way of processing your own thoughts there. Whereas with what I was doing with the musical, obviously, is you're trying to add to the story, the emotion of the story.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I remember I was there. I think I was watching a year three class or a year two class that day. I don't remember. Maybe I even saw it twice, but I saw it and I remember the music specifically. And I don't even know which song it was right now. Something with, I want to say Fireflies. Did you have something called Something Fireflies?
Mm.
Maybe. Or.
Can you remember what was happening on the stage at the time?
Oh, it was when, yes, I don't know if it, I think it must've been Neverland. And then they met this new group. So
boys,
maybe it was the Lost Boys and they had some fairies or something dancing around them.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
I don't know. It was too long ago, but, anyway, the music was just so spectacular for that. And then I remember. So I wasn't sure if you were just a musician playing these songs out of someone else's rendition. You know, like you and I had never sat down and talked about like that you had written these songs. It wasn't until maybe a few weeks later, possibly even a few months later, I was talking to another colleague of ours, I think in the elementary department, and I told them that maybe I wanted to have you on the show or that you and I had done some improv together. And they were like, oh, is she the one that did the music for Peter Pan? I said, yeah, she's the one that played the piano. And they said, oh my God, can you believe that she wrote all those songs? That's so incredible. And I thought, she wrote the songs? That's crazy, you know? I had no idea. So that's really impressive that you did that. And the songs were so beautiful, so well arranged.
Well, thank you. I mean,
that was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, anyone that creates something, they mean a lot to me personally. And then of course it's great when other people like them too. I think that,
sure.
You know, I think a lot of stuff that, well, I can only speak for myself, but stuff that I write, I can't really do, you know, that it is as it is and you either take it or leave it. Do you know what I mean? I don't spend ages working and working and working on things, you know, unless if I'm not happy with it, then I'll change it. But it's such a part of me. I mean, it sounds sappy, but like, I just feel like it's part of who I am, like my soul in a way. And, you know, you either like it or you don't. Yeah. So it's nice to hear that you did like it. That's great.
Perfect.
Thank you.
So yeah, that was just a really impressive thing to see and to hear. So, but also I think we should maybe go back a bit, because I feel like there's so much about your years in the UK that I don't know anything about. So do you want to tell me a bit about like where you went to school and maybe what your first passion was? Because I know that you're really into a few different creative mediums.
Sure. Well, where did it all start? I mean, I suppose it really started with dancing when I was 2. I danced from 2 oh, wow. to about 16. I did ballet, and I'm just really not very flexible. So I wasn't the best ballerina. But I did my best, and
I wasn't either.
No, well, I don't know. I could imagine you in a tutu, Jordan.
I can wear one. I just can't dance.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd have it on tonight. I'm quite disappointed, mind you. I can't see your bottom half, so for all I know, you've got it on. Yeah. So and I did tap dancing, which I loved, and then as part of my dance school, every 2 years, 3 years, I can't remember the frequency of it, we would do a show, and I was, well, the class, my class was asked to audition to sing songs from Les Miserables, and I ended up getting one of the singing roles, and from then on I started to sing, and I started with the violin, and then pestered my parents to let me learn the piano, and then eventually had singing lessons as well. So, you know, I was big into music, less so dancing. Wasn't really a world I felt super comfortable with, although now I'm grateful that I did do that. At school I was in string orchestra, the main orchestra, chamber choir, the senior choir. Then later on I took the junior chamber choir and directed that as a student. When I went to university, university was interesting. I actually got a singing scholarship, and then they gave me this horrible singing teacher who just made me cry after every lesson. She was like forcing my voice, and I'd had enough of that. So singing then sort of became something that I just did for myself. I didn't even try to get a scholarship the next year. But at university, I was part of the Madrigal Choir. You know what madrigals are?
What's that?
You'll be into this. Elizabethan songs. a lot of fa-la-las and tar-triddly-dees and things like that. And we did a little tour of the UK in that choir. And it was really great for sort of exploring different harmonies and things like that. I was also in the Renaissance group. And I have a love of music of all genres, you know, from very early music to more sort of, very much contemporary stuff like Taverner.
That's a huge range of things. That's a huge range of things to be tapping into. How old were you around that time?
Well, university, I was, 18 to 21.
Okay, wow.
Just
what happened?
An enormous crash. I don't know what that was.
Oh, weird. Something in the apartment.
No, I don't think so. I think it might be my neighbor. I'm hoping
we have that issue.
I'm hoping it's not a gerbil. I'm pretty sure they're not that big. anyway, yes,
they've grown sentient. They're ready. They're getting their revenge.
Oh,
now.
They are very. Oh, yeah, I've got gerbil babies and everything. Don't worry, we're not keeping them all. anyway, back to the music, I guess.
Yeah, you had been, so music was like this huge thing you were a part of, and you know, did you, like, when you went to bed at night after a great day in one of these choirs, did you have a dream of, you know, being a singer more, or a musician more, or writing songs?
Oh, I wanted to be a film composer. That was very much that's what I wanted to do.
That's really cool, wow.
Yes, I suppose, I spent a year in France, I didn't actually, it ended up being half a year. I actually met a British, he's actually a painter. He's done quite well for himself, who's married to a French lady. And he was looking for a native English speaker to sing. I saw this at the university. I was studying in Toulouse. And I got in contact and I ended up having the most fabulous summer writing songs with him and also adapting his songs and taking his wife's poetry and creating, you know, writing melodies for that. And that was just fabulous. And when I came back from university, I said, right, I know what I want to do. I want to finish my degree. My degree was in French and linguistics. I want to finish my degree and then I want to go on to study composition. But in the end, that was not going to happen because, well, it was just felt that that wouldn't be a very, you know, secure path to go down. And in the end, I spent a few resentful years because I felt like I hadn't really achieved what I wanted to. But now I actually feel that it's taken a little while, but my job is allowing me to pursue a lot of my dreams that I never would have expected it to, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you say that, you know, you had this epiphany that it wasn't going to be a fruitful path to take, was that more of you facing your own fears in a way, or was it someone else's influence?
No, it was someone else's influence. Oh,
okay. Was it a parent? It's Yeah.
It was fear talking, and it was probably correct, you know, it was probably right, but who knows? I mean, I think the thing for me is, hang on a sec.
Just leave everything rolling.
Because there's a lot of noise.
For sure.
And I don't know what's going on. Hang on. Okay, I know what the noise was now. It was my neighbor having a Riva delivery and they dropped a whole bag of stuff all
over. Oh, man. Oh, that stinks.
The doors that I can to avoid the noise. What great timing. That never happens. And it happened this
evening. What a nice coincidence that someone's getting groceries cool. delivered and they spilled the oranges, you know?
Well, I think it was, you know, oranges in glass jars because it was a heck of a noise. Man. Anyway, at least it's not the gerbils. That's all I can say.
But you were saying, you know, you had this turning point and you felt maybe, I'm sure at that time you probably felt a little resentful, as we all would.
I did,
you know,
feel,
as a, I think any creative person would feel that way. Like there's definitely moments, even in my own like musical journey or whatever, or getting into new things, like getting into podcasting, getting into radio. Even when I was in university, I was really torn between, I really wanted to be an actor, and then I was also trying to be a sketch comedy writer, and I also wanted to be a musician. I couldn't really identify what I was strongest at. And, you know, there's sometimes you hit a wall, and you either have a voice in your ear saying, like, just push a little harder, and the wall will come crumbling down, or you have a voice saying, like, hey, that's a pretty thick wall, and just over there is plywood. You can just punch right through that. You know, you just have... Everyone gets to that point, so I'm sure that you felt resentful for that. But I think it's really cool that you're in a job now that allows you to explore those freedoms. Like, can you explain more?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just, I think, you know, there was a lot of resentment. I was quite resentful for quite a long time. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy being a teacher. It wasn't like I was trying to fit into a job where I didn't feel I fit. I felt like it was a good match for me, but I just felt there was so much untapped potential that I never really had the chance to develop and work on and explore.
Sure.
Because of fear.
Yeah.
From, you know, elsewhere. But, you know, now I've been able to put on my musical. I've been able to teach improv, explore improv. Every day that I'm preparing my lessons, it is very, very creative because especially, you know, when you're teaching things like the novel To Kill a Mockingbird, you really have to, you know, you've got a novel that is written in the 50s, set in the 30s, but it's still so relevant with its themes today. So how can I put that across to the kids so that they understand why they're learning this? And, you know, it's a lot of looking at what resources are out there and creating these sort of hybrids of different resources, my own ideas, and mixing them all together. And I find it really exciting and satisfying. It does satisfy my creative, like, hunger, as it were, you know. So even that, just on one, you know, just in my day job, I find that it is, it's not, it wouldn't be enough by itself, because I need that, the music and the theatre. I do want to have that as well. But I mean, standing in front of a class is great theatre.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It is.
I love having them, getting them to laugh. It's great. Yeah. You know?
I mean, every performer loves the stage, no matter the size, you know?
That's right.
It's so true.
As long as I'm in the limelight, no. But
no, but it's true. I mean, it's true in a sense. Everyone who loves to perform will perform in any circumstance. I mean, people who pop in those elevator jokes, you know, or it, maybe in a classroom, or maybe, you know, in between songs in some weird, unexpected setting, there's still everyone, you know, if you love to perform, then you just love to perform. And there's, you know, you'll do it anywhere you can. But I think that's really, really cool that you found this opportunity to do it there. And I also thought, like, and we'll talk about it in more detail, but we did an improv comedy show together. My only one that I ever did in Germany since I've moved here, actually, thanks to you. And
I've tried to persuade you to do more.
And as soon as we can, I would love to, actually, because it's something that I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot, and I enjoyed the rehearsals, and it felt like I was back in university. But I also wonder, you know, when you were fighting hard to be a full-time musician, did you have like musical idols that you looked up to, people that you said, okay, I want to try and do what this person's doing? Or did you just, or not really, you just left all kinds and you wanted to do it too?
The thing is, the stuff that I write, I'm not sure how marketable it is. Do you see what I mean? So I didn't really feel that I was trying to emulate any particular singer or musician. Mm-hmm. I'd find inspiration in lots of different places. And also people often say to me, oh, what kind of music do you sing? Because at the moment I find, so, you know, I'm also a mom and I'm working full time, obviously. So I find that I don't have huge amounts of creative space. And I've kind of just learned to accept that for the time being. So I tend to do, you know, the music that I do, it tends to be, you know, a lot of cover things where I get a lot of inspiration from, you know, all over the place. And it depends on what mood I'm in, you know, I don't know about other people, but it, you know, sometimes I can be inspired by Miss Dolly Parton, you know, I mean, it can just be as diverse as that.
She's very inspirational.
The other day, she's wonderful. And I was watching the other day, you know, the beatboxer, Kevin, I can't remember his second name now, from the Pentatonix, who plays his cello and does his beatboxing. And it's such a diversity. And also, you know, the old, you know, singers, Nina Simone and all,
sure.
You know, anything and everything.
So you can kind of just be inspired by someone who's great at their craft.
Right, yeah. Exactly. I'm not particularly attached to one thing. And I also found a lot of really great, just totally random things. Like there's a beautiful Danish song that I think is so wonderful, the harmonies in it and the softness of the melody and the peace that it kind of brings out in me. So I wouldn't say there's one person, you know, there are artists that I admire. I think I tend to admire people for their honesty when they're true to themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I find myself like getting so torn on the same thing, but currently, you know, I would say there's one or two styles that I do best within my skill range, but I can also get inspired by such completely different styles of music. And then I think to myself that that's something I'd want to pursue. And either I just don't do it, or when I try to do something like it, I get discouraged, or maybe in the end, I still make something within my range at the end of the day anyway. You know what I mean? Like the only real challenges I've had recently in terms of trying to explore musically is through collaboration, which has really been a beneficial thing for me in the last few months, because I'm always doing the same kind of music more or less. Like I have a direction that I enjoy playing in, but there's this beat maker and rapper. He's my friend Matt, but his artist name is Tom Yanks. And he's just been really encouraging and really fun to work with these last few months. He makes these crazy like chill hop, sort of trappy, cool hip hop beats. And sometimes he just says, hey, you know, do you hear like a melody on there? And even though it's my voice and it's within my range, because there's a new foundation there, it's not my acoustic guitar or whatever. It's a whole new world and a new beat and a new vibe. It gives me like a whole, it puts me in a whole different kind of room as opposed to like, let's say I'm always singing in a church. He says, hey, why don't you sing in this mall, on this mall escalator? That's just like a totally different scenario. And you're like, oh, I didn't know that I could do that. And that's really fun.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd love to do some collaboration. I've always looked to do that. I think it's often, well, I find it difficult to find people to collaborate with. And I think also my own confidence in what I can do. I think the creative side is fine. I don't think there's an issue there. But when it comes to, you know, the technicalities behind the music, there I feel that I'm rather wanting. And but it might be nice to collaborate with someone who does understand more or who has a better feel for that, because for me it's really a struggle. You know, I hear that chord next, but what is that damn chord?
Oh yeah, I'm the same. I'm so untechnical with that sort of stuff. If someone wants to collaborate and they say like, hey, here's this demo, it's at 90 BPM, it's in the key of G minor, I go like, well, I know that one of those chords is G minor, but I don't know that scale. You know, I'd have to really take time with it.
Yeah. But I think you either have that or you don't, because I mean, I've tried to train that so hard and it's just, it doesn't work out for me. So I'm very extraordinarily intuitive and, you know, wonder whether that, you know, is looked down upon, is frowned upon. At the end of the day, I think I've reached a point where I don't really care. That's what I do. And, you know, that's what I do. And I'm happy to learn and expand my horizons and learn from other people and just be gracious about what I can do, but also be open about what other people can do as well. And I think that's a way to, you know, push yourself as
well. Do you think seeing how your life is now, if you could have gone back to your university days or maybe even before that, and known that if you just, you know, flip this one light switch the other way, that you would, you know, become a very successful, very famous actress or a very successful, very famous musician, you know, would you have gone back to make that choice? And if you did, which one would you think you'd make?
So what do you ask me? Would I have made the choice in the first
place? Like, let's say that you could, like, you are who you are now. And you can go back in time. That's the first choice. Would you go back and make this choice different? Would you change something? And if you could, would you want to come out of it as a famous actress or as a famous musician, like successful, like in your own right?
Okay. Well, I think if I had to choose between the two, I'd go for a musician.
Yeah.
Simply because, like I said earlier, that what I have written, I just feel it is, oh, this sounds so cheesy, I don't know how to put it, but it's just like, it feels like that's my essence and it is me, and no apologies.
Yeah, lay on the queso, you know? It's an art, it's called artsy fartsy immigrants, you know?
Lay on the queso, baby. All right, but would I have done it? I've been through some hard stuff, especially in the last, 5 years of my life. I'm happy about who I am right now. And I think that it's been hard won.
Yeah.
Is my life perfect? No, but you've shown me someone who has a perfect life. And I think that what I've learned has given me a lot, you know, I have a lot of integrity, a lot more, just self-awareness and awareness that I also have a right to occupy space in the world and have, you know, whereas I think, I don't know, if I'd had an easier path, perhaps I wouldn't have the strength that I have now, you know.
It's a good perspective.
Because
No, I was just, I was going to ask a new question, but I thought maybe you had you still had more in the tank on that one.
Yeah, well, I think that, so like I said, I feel like at the moment I'm not, one of the reasons I love improv is that it's spontaneous and I can just go for it in the moment. When it comes to actually, yeah, writing music or sketches or sitting down and writing a poem or whatever, then I feel sometimes I'll be lucky and I'll have this sudden flash and I'll just, you know, work on it and it'll be, you know, time just disappears or what have you. But right now I don't experience that so much. And like I said earlier, I kind of, I've just learned to accept that. And I think that that's going to come back at some point, you know, when my life is less hectic, when my daughter's older and can be more independent. I'm not afraid that I've lost that. It's just for another point in my life. And yeah. I think that the things that I'm gathering now, the things that I'm learning now will help to fuel that later on. But I think if I just kind of lament the fact, oh, I never get to write, I never get to, you know, I'm rubbish, I don't write music anymore. No, I'm not writing it right now. Hmm. You know, I still have ideas, I still get stuff down, and it's not completely gone, but it's just, I really just think you just go through different stages in your
absolutely
life.
And, yeah.
You know.
You also, like we've talked about a little bit, and I said I wanted to jump into further, was, you know, we did this improv show together, and I think it's really interesting when people split their creative interests into sometimes doubles or quadruples, whatever it may be, triplets. And I think when one of those is improv, that piques my interest a lot, because you see that sometimes with jazz musicians. You see that with, oh, what's his name? This crazy comedian who writes sketch. Eric Andre. Eric Andre. I don't know if you know who he is.
Yeah,
I don't know if know if he's your type of humor. It's very absurdist. It's very, very, very like, it's very absurdist, but and it's very intense. Sometimes it's not funny. Sometimes it's great. But Eric Andre, you know, he went to a very established, prolific jazz university, I think for upright bass. And then he comes out of it this crazy, kooky, absurdist, you know, comic style. And that kind of thing makes sense. But when you're, you know, with your background and your interest of film composition, you come from choir, you come from piano, things like that, you're studying language. You know, when did you have a moment where you found improv interesting? Did you have like a show or something as a kid, or did you have how did you get into it?
Oh, well, it's interesting. So as a kid, I used to watch Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yes, yes, the same.
Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie were always my
same
favorites, and Mike McShane.
Same.
Yeah.
I always found I always thought Wayne Brady was impressive, especially with the music games. I thought, wow, I can't believe he made that up. But Ryan Stiles just has that, like, that little thing. He has that, just that flavor.
Yeah, and there's the woman Jodie. Is it Jodie?
She looked like the punk rocker. Did she wear like the leather jackets sometimes? Jody or Jane something?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
I think I might know who
you mean. I remember her name now, but I thought she was great too. Yeah. So I used to watch this when I was growing up, and absolutely loved it. I thought it was hilarious. But it never really occurred to me that this was a thing that I could do.
No way.
Because, you know, I was brought up in Northwest England. There ain't that much going on. Do you know what I mean? And one day, so in 2014, I had my daughter, and I'd gone through a rough time. And one day, I was back at work, and I was sitting in a meeting at work, a staff meeting. And one of my friends, my colleagues, she said, "I said, what are you doing this evening?" She said, "Oh, I'm going to improv group." I said, "Well, what?" "Yeah, improv." I said, "Oh, can I come?" And I went with her, and I had a great time. So I started out in this open English-speaking improv group in Munich called Scuba Drivers. And I was with them for a few years. And that's when afterwards I really decided, you know, I want to do this. I love this. This is so interesting. And I also got into sort of accompanying, you know, improv music to accompany the shows. So the musicals, it sort of fulfilled the dramatic side, the theatrical side, and the musical side as well. So it ticked all the boxes. And that's when, I sort of Gargan, who I met, who you know, who we did that, the Midsummer Madness Festival with that you did, you know, the Eye of Effect sketch that we did. Him and another friend of mine, Mustafa, who at the time of the Midsummer Madness, he was busy doing his PhD thesis, so he couldn't be there. But that's when we kind of got together and tried to do some improv together. And then they cleared off and went off and did a lot of stand-up comedy, which is great for them. But then I got into Bake This, which is the sort of semi-pro English-speaking improv group here in Munich. And I've been with them ever since. And it's great. I have a great time. It's great fun. And it's what I love. I get to do all this brilliant, exciting, creative stuff, and I don't have to learn lines or music. Right. I can just let it out, and it's just fabulous. It's and the spontaneity of it, the rabbit holes that you can fall down, like the doors you open endless. In your mind,
endless. I can't believe that you didn't get into it until 2014. It seemed like something you had been passionate. Or 2016.
No, 2016.
That's even crazier, because to me it seemed like something like, by the time I met you and we were talking properly about doing this together, I thought that was something you had been doing since you were in high school, something you had always had a passion for.
No, but I mean, I suppose I was a bit of a closet improviser, you know. I mean, should I admit this? You know, I'm one of those kids that'll have a little, you know, there's all these tapes of me when I was seven interviewing myself as some character on the radio. So, you know, I think I had it in me.
Oh yeah.
It was there, right? It just didn't have an outlet.
It's such a crazy natural thing for you. And I remember when we rehearsed the first time at your place for the show, and I felt, I felt like really thrilled about it, because it reminded me so much of the years of improv that I did at my university that I loved doing. Mm-hmm. I loved doing it. And it put me right back. You know, we used to do these, I was part of a team, and we did the orientation shows for the incoming freshmen for the university. So we were in the amphitheater. It was like somewhere between like maybe 150 or 300 seats. And a really nice wooden stage and a big red velvet curtain that you came out of, and we all had matching t-shirts, and just that energy, you know. And the first couple times that we did it, it was all these young, fresh, smiling faces, and we were super warm. You know, we were doing it like twice a week, every week for months, and you just come out super warm, completely on the same level. You know everyone's strengths. You know what everyone plays better. You know someone's going to have a certain character that you can play your best off of. You start learning which duos within the group have a really strong chemistry, and when you come out that fresh and you're just killing, like you're killing. Mm-hmm. There's nothing better than that feeling. Nothing is better than that feeling. When you're just, right. You see, right. Like you have to stop talking because you're not mic'd up and the laughing is too loud. That's the best feeling. That's the best. And doing that just reminded me so much of that.
And seeing the audience relaxing. Like at the beginning of the show, they're kind of, oh, what is this?
Like, what, improv?
And they just completely relax into it. Yeah. No,
oh, it's really, really cool, man. I had this mentor, a really good friend of mine. His name was Corey. And he was the head of the team, and he must have run it for... In my memory, he ran it for about 6 years, but it could have been less. Mm-hmm. But he was, he was just the OG. You know, he knew, his favorite thing was mostly short form games. And, well, actually, you know, this might be a good chance to talk about this to people who don't know anything about improv. I do forget sometimes on this show that people who listen aren't necessarily creative people in everything we talk about. So do you want to explain a little bit about what short form is and what long form is to someone who wouldn't know at all?
Yeah, sure. I'll try my best. So, I mean, short form improv tend to be games that might last anywhere between a minute to maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and they can take all sorts of forms. So you might, I know a couple of ones I just pulled out of the air. No P is quite a funny one. So that's where you have to create a scene and you're not allowed to use the letter P. Or any other letter that can be determined by the audience, it's a fast paced game. And the way I've played it before, like with the kids at school, for example, when I trained them up, was they use the letter and then they're out, and then someone else comes in and we've got a new letter, and it's, you know, sort of very fast paced. Something else you might play would be blind date, where you have two people, you know, who have to create these spontaneous characters, and they're on a speed dating. It's called speed dating. Yeah, speed dating. They have to create a short scene. And then I think the other thing about improv is the timing, you know, feeling the beat. When is it time to move on? Yeah. So, you know, these speed dating scenes, they might last a few seconds. People might not say anything. It might just be a gesture or a look that gets the audience, you know, and there's the beauty of that scene. And then you move on.
You have to trust
one.
Your teammate to either tap you out or to cross the stage to cut the whole scene. Right. I mean, I guess someone like my mom, who is probably curious about this, like, whose line is it anyway? All of that is short form. Like scenes from a hat, yeah. These short, like everything is very short, punchy. You know, sometimes Ryan Stiles or Colin Mockery, for example, would come out, just give the crowd a look, you know, and that's their bit. They're out next, you know, and that's short form. Mm-hmm. But how would you explain long form? Because that, you know, the Herald and things like that, these formulas can be a bit trickier.
Yeah, I mean, I've only done the Herald once or twice, actually. Our long forms that we tend to do with Bake This, we do a lot of improvised musicals, which is my absolute favorite.
I can see that.
Oh, God. Yes. And there, you know, there are sort of, you're looking at anything between 20 minutes. I mean, we've not done one that's gone on for an hour or something like that, but there, you can easily have, you know, a long form improv that goes on for an hour where you're building a storyline. It could be a linear storyline. You can also have free form. I love doing free form. That can go on for a long time, where you're kind of playing off ideas that, you know, there's not necessarily a linear story that follows, but you might be suddenly inspired by something someone said or a movement somebody made, or suddenly a song pops into your head that's linked to something that's happening on the stage. And And then there are, you know, there are formats like the Herald, which are pretty, you know, structured, mm-hmm. and you're following this pattern. But I don't have as much experience in that because it's not really something that we do in my group.
Me either. I'm also not as familiar with it. And I remember the last year that I did my group was a bit of a troublesome one, because I was like, Corey left, and then at this point that he was gone, we had another guy named Robert who was taking over for a short time as like the head of the group and running the rehearsals and trying to orchestrate the certain shows that we were doing. And then I think after that, I think when Robert left, then there was like a vote going up for who would do it next. And at this point, I was really headstrong about the group and really passionate about it. And I kind of campaigned amongst the group, like, you know, I would love to do this. I really want to follow in the footsteps of Corey. I really love his teaching. If you like what he did, I'm going to try and give you a similar thing. And then I got voted in, and it wasn't even just a few months of being head of the group. We had this guy who at the time I really resented for this, but now it's almost funny to me how seriously I took it. Because it was just a college improv group. But when you love something that much, you know, it's life or death in the moment. But I had this, we had this teammate on the group named Carmichael, and he was very funny. I mean, there's nothing against his talent. He was very funny, which almost made me hate him more, you know? But he was just so passionate about trying to push the group into more of a long-form competitive strategy. Like, I really think he tried to get us into a place where perhaps we could compete nationally for, maybe he wanted to get seen by, you know, this like Second City. You know, he wanted to get involved into a place where he could escalate himself and get to perhaps every true improver's dream, which is like SNL. You know, I don't know, but he had this thing about it, and he made it really complicated for me as the leader. He made it very troublesome, and he made it very unfun for me, because everyone else was kind of relaxed and just having a good time, but then he just really wanted to take over. And then at some point, I resigned. I just said, like, I can't do this anymore, you know. And then I was so, I teared up. I took it so personally. And of course, no one else was really running against him. So he's like, I'll do it. And then they threw in all their names in a hat. And they're just like, yeah, sure, he can do it. But then after that, after a few months, it just fell apart. Then some people were graduating. Some people were moving out of the group. We had two girls, unfortunately, who were very sick. They fell really ill. So they were out. And after that, I felt like it was just over. Like I had just lost this thing we were going for. So it's crazy how you can get so, so into things like that, you know?
Well, but I think it's great. But I do understand this. For me, this idea about being doing it competitively, it's not something it's not a world that I'm familiar with. It's not something that really attracts me. And I think, so I think that in an improv group, if you've got one person alone pushing, things are going to fall apart. You know, it should be the whole group. You know, you want to try and have a group that works effectively together. Like you were saying before, you know, you understand the different people in the group. You know how people tick. You know what combinations work well together. You know, you can sense when somebody's maybe struggling and you need to go in and help them out, you know, whereas, you know, it sounds there that you've got someone who's so concerned about pushing the group for their own gain.
Right.
I don't see how that can create a good improv group. The fun would be gone, and that sounds like what happened there with
exactly.
And to me, it's all about fun, you know.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I mean, even just this one show that we did together. You know, I had a lot of cobwebs to try and knock off in those couple of rehearsals we did, and I didn't succeed knocking them all off, but there was still a couple of moments where something just clicked, either with you or with Gagan, for example.
Gagan, yeah.
And something just worked, and I felt exactly like smack dab back on that orientation stage, hearing the handful of people or whatever just really giving a good gut laugh, and was like, oh, man, I miss that. I miss yeah. that. So like being funny, feeling funny, but also not making it about me, but making it more like, guys, we're killing this, and then tagging out, and it's right. someone else's turn.
Right. And when you have that chemistry and that magic on the stage, you don't feel, it kind of comes naturally. You don't have to force anything, you know? I mean, the whole point is it's improvised. You shouldn't have to go on having thought, oh, I'm going to try and get this one-liner and all that, you know, or make the people laugh here or do this funny thing. I mean, it just happens. It's just organic because the whole group is working together
yeah.
and supporting each other and listening to each other and reacting and, you know, complimenting each other. And that's where the magic lies. And the audience sense that they get.
Have you also had some pretty complicated experiences like with improv groups in Munich, like the one that I had in university, where you had people trying to not sabotage it, but sort of take it somewhere you didn't feel comfortable?
I've been bulldozed a few times on stage, which I always find difficult to deal with, because to me that's
what do you mean by bulldozed?
Well, I mean I'll be set. One example was I set up a scene. It was a sort of hero's journey type format, and there was this one sort of link missing in the chain, and I thought, right, this is my calling. I need to go on and become this link, you know. So I sort of went on and I set up this character, and then another player came out and essentially swiped me off the stage and started creating a second character. This person was already playing a significant character in this play, and then they started to create this missing link character, which left my character with no purpose. I came on stage, I said something, and then that was it. That was it. That the character was gone, and I've never experienced that before. And that made me feel, yeah, I was pretty upset by that, because that to me is, I mean, I think it came from a place of fear from that other player, you know, thinking, oh my God, where is this going? We have to pull this together.
Right.
But I feel like that's one of the most dangerous things that can happen, you know, I find myself doing that, standing backstage going, okay, what the hell is going on now? We've got this storyline and something's going on here and there. I've got to try and pull this together. You know, and that's when panic sets in, and it's probably not going to go well after that. You know, the more you can relax and let the story tell itself, the more likely you are to come out with these magical storylines or magical endings or magical twists in the plot. Yeah. The more control you try and put mm-hmm. into it, the less, you know, it's not going to be as good, basically. And that bulldozing that I have experienced, I think it was from somebody panicking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Basically. Yeah. I've definitely been in a few situations where panic led to a forced narrative that, like you said, kills a character, or it completely derails something that the other people had been setting up for quite some time. Like this unspoken lead up to a huge punchline. We just haven't quite found where it's going to be yet, but it's going to be the great way to end this. And then someone either, you know, pre-plans a line that they thought was funny off stage, which is like the biggest no-no ever, or they got nervous and didn't get where it was going and chopped it off, you know, and that hurts. It hurts so much when you put work into it and you feel it cooking, and then someone just throws the pot off the stovetop and you're like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, you know, you just have to learn from it and move on and try not to, you know, try and, because we're all guilty of not listening on the stage, and that's one of the worst things you can do is not listen. And you know, I mean, you just have to learn, you know, learn from your own mistakes, learn from other people's mistakes, and just try and be a better improviser. Try and listen more.
Do you think there's any?
Be more.
Do you
open.
Think there's any? Like, do you think there's any grounding in this theory that for people like us with improv, because it forces you so much to be present in the moment with zero, what is the word I was thinking of? Like no compromises. Like you have to be here in the moment or you really mess it up for everybody. Do you see that could be similar to how other people treat meditation? Like maybe it's a kind of therapy that for us, for those 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you are nowhere else but flowing in this moment. You have to be present and you want to be. Your brain is really like channeled in. You don't think about anything else if it's going well. Mm-hmm. Do you think like a good 5 minute short form game where you're just laughing and the juices are flowing and you're just there could considered like similar to how people treat meditation, where you're trying to be present and clear your mind?
Yeah, I've often thought about that comparison myself. I think there is something in it. However, I think that meditation brings an inner stillness that might not.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know,
yeah,
that you're pumped up with the adrenaline, I guess.
It's like a drug. Yeah, maybe it's not the same.
Yeah. No, but it is in the sense of you are, it is in the sense of your focus.
Yeah.
You know, like you've just said, you know, it's this kind of mindfulness, you know, that's the trendy word right now, isn't it? But it's true. I mean, you can do that in other aspects of your life. You know, the one that always makes me laugh is that mindfully brush your teeth or whatever.
Do you do that?
No. I have a weird thing about people brushing their teeth.
What is it?
I can't. It's, whenever I hear someone brushing their teeth or I think about it, I get cold shivers and goosebumps.
Wait, when you, like, let's say you're watching someone brush their teeth.
Yeah.
Is it a manual toothbrush? Is it an electric toothbrush? Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
What if someone's like, picking their teeth, like they get like something stuck, like some lettuce?
Ach, that doesn't bother me.
But the what if I dipped my finger in water and brushed like this? It has to be the stick. Yeah. What about when what about when you're like teaching your daughter to brush her teeth? Did it gross you out?
It's not like it grosses me out. It just like makes me goosebumps.
Is it like an ASMR thing?
I don't know. It's just weird. I've never met any. I've even Googled it, like, to see if other people have this weird thing. And there are people out there. I'm not alone. I might start.
Do they have? You should start like a subreddit.
It doesn't bother me when I'm brushing my teeth. Well, it may be just a little bit at the beginning. But look, this is so.
No. But this is interesting.
How did we
this
get
is
on interesting. This subject?
Is it something about like the cleansing of a dirty mouth, or is it the fact that you're putting plastic? Because for me, like when I brush my teeth in the morning, I brush it for way longer than I have to because I feel so gross. Like from the, you feel like spit on your teeth and the breath is so bad and you're just like digging in and digging in. But in the evening, it's a normal quick, you know, it's a normal 2 minutes or whatever. Like, okay, that's it. I feel good. It's fine. But like for you, is it,
I think it's,
you know, what is it?
It's the bristles on the teeth.
Oh, okay.
I think.
What about when, like in movies, when they have the camera inside the mouth and the toothbrush, like is.
Oh, no.
No?
No, no. Oh, thanks.
Do you have anything else like that? Is it like clipping the toenails or flossing? Flossing? No?
That's fine.
Interesting.
It's just brushing teeth, and I don't like the sound of a spade being scraped across some concrete.
A spade being scraped across what's a spade again?
A shovel.
I asked nicely. A spade.
But that is
a frustrating sound, like this.
Like. Right. Well, just imagine that. That is like on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being like someone brushing their teeth. The shovel is about a 6 or 7.
But the toothbrush is a 10.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Did anyone ever show you these ASMR videos before?
I've with people eating cucumbers.
Or whatever, yeah.
I've seen
Did you get this tingly spine feeling that people get? No. I don't get it either.
I just wondered what the point was of that, really.
The first time I watched a few, and for those who don't know what ASMR means, I forget what it stands for. Let me look it up really quick. I think it's audio sensory. What does ASMR stand for? I just want to make sure. Autonomous sensory meridian response. Very fancy. But like for those who don't know what that is, essentially it's this extremely popular style of video making and audio. It's mostly audio. That's the whole reason behind it. But it's apparently there's a phenomenon that takes place with a lot of people where if you turn the sensitivity on a microphone all the way up, where you just barely make any sounds like scratching your hand or just whispering, maybe just biting against something, is a very crispy, crispy, big, compressed, condensed sound. It gives people this is what they say, that it gives like the brain and the back of their neck and their spine like this tingly, sort of like ooey gooey warm sensation. And I don't get that sensation from these videos, but I think it's really interesting that that got so popular.
I don't have any ooey gooey when people are brushing their teeth. I just want to run away.
That's so interesting to me.
It's not ASMR. I have Headspace. You know Headspace?
Yeah. There?
And they have these sleep casts, which are quite cool. And one of them is, a couple of them, I think, are ASMR. And I put one on once, and it's just this woman whispering. And it really annoyed me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to the nice man talking.
The first time I saw an ASMR, I thought it was a sexual thing. I thought it was like a new sort of
Is it because it's got S and M in it?
You would know, wouldn't you?
Would I? Would I really? Would I, Jordan?
I thought it was kind of sexual because the first one that I saw was this woman. And of course, yeah, it's a lot of whispering. They're whispering up against the mic, and it was a lady like,
yeah,
like, hi, you know, I'm Jennifer, and today I'm going to eat a pickle or something.
Yeah, well, this is it. Like, it's some woman eating a pickle. I mean, and that's what I couldn't understand. I also thought this, is this a, you know, a new thing?
Yeah.
But it was, I just thought it was unnecessary.
Do you get...
So I turned it off. I lasted about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I didn't get it at all. But there is this one thing that's similar to ASMR, but it's purely visual. It's I don't know if you're into anything on Reddit at all, but there is a subreddit called Oddly Satisfying. And they also have their own video channel, I guess on YouTube and on TikTok and things like that, Instagram. But they do these just short, sort of unexpectedly weird visual things, but they are oddly satisfying. Like, for example, if you have, you might know the name for this. I'm so bad with stuff like this that I never use, but like a big spoon with the drainer holes in it.
A draining,
draining spoon? Yeah.
That's what they're called.
That's what it is. And what they'll do is maybe take like a handful of sort of malleable wet mud and then take the drainer spoon on top of the other hand and press it down so that the mud squirts through the little holes kind of like spaghetti. And something about seeing that is kind of like, you know, yeah.
But not happy, not in a happy way.
No, not for you.
That bothers me. It makes me feel icky.
My brother-in-law has a thing for there's another sort of subreddit or this popular video trend or picture trend even for like OCD people. I mean, I'm sure they're just using that in a broad stroke, not in a literal term, but just like, for example, when you get a new toothpaste and they take off the aluminum foil on the top and it's just a perfectly clean, unused.
You know, you just said the word toothpaste.
But do you have anything, do you feel that way when they show like a perfectly unused, I don't know, or like a charged phone or like a unused, I don't know, things that when you use them, they get messy. So they just open it and it's just fresh and clean. Maybe I'm using bad examples.
It doesn't bother me.
Okay.
Sorry, I know you're trying to make me have to be even more weird than I really am, but it's just not working.
I'm just trying to see if there's anything that makes sense because the toothbrush thing doesn't make sense.
No, but I looked it up. I can't remember what it's called now. It's some, I mean, I've diagnosed myself, which is always a good idea, yeah, isn't it?
Always accurate.
Yeah, but I can't remember what it's called now. It's something sensory. I could Google it for you if you like.
But, yeah, maybe you can send it to me after this and I'll put it in the show notes.
Sure thing.
Do you have a goal to like write and record and like produce, for example, your own album?
No, I'd like to do a new musical. That's what I'd like to do.
Would you like to write the whole story and everything?
I actually want to do music for my favorite book, The Little Prince. That would be my next.
That would be pretty cool.
It's been done. There are musicals of The Little Prince, but I want to do my own.
I could see that.
But I'm not promising I'm going to do that. I'm just saying that's kind of that is something that I would like to do.
But before you were to sit down with a piano and write your own songs, you'd prefer to do a musical.
Well, my own songs kind of creep up on me. I often am inspired by a poem that I read or whatever, and then I'll set that to music. I did things like a couple of the Shakespeare sonnets and things like that. It can be something that it'll just occur to me and I'll just sit down and do it. I don't have any real ambitions to sit down and write an album, I suppose, because I've never been in that world.
Right.
You know, when when I was in France and now that I've been here, it's the most creative place I've been. Before, like in the UK, it was never really encouraged. You know, if you wrote your own stuff, if you wrote your own music, you were a show off, you know.
They said that?
Oh God, yeah. I've been called a show off a million times. Yeah. When I was growing up at school.
God.
So it's not, it wasn't really, I didn't feel that I had a right in a way to kind of pursue anything like that.
Of course not. Not when people tell you that you're a show off for trying.
Mm-hmm. So it was lovely. It was the first time when I was in France and I sort of, I bought myself a guitar to take with me and I could play about 5 chords or something, just to accompany myself because I obviously couldn't take a piano with me. And it was so lovely to be amongst people where you could grab the guitar and sing a few songs and everyone would join in. And instead of, you know, people telling you to shut up and stop, you know, showing off or whatever, it was just about, yeah, let's all sing together. Let's all enjoy the music together. Do you know what I mean?
Like, sure.
Because it wasn't about doing a performance. It wasn't about, you know, oh, look at me. It wasn't about that at all. But that's always the way that it had been interpreted in the UK. I think it's just a different mindset, a different openness to creativity and culture.
I mean, that's how I always felt about it in New Orleans, you know, was that trying different things and trying to collaborate with people and explore musical ideas and, you know, being artsy fartsy at its purest was, mm-hmm. you know, more than welcomed. In fact, it was encouraged and in fact, you know, they it was almost like a stamp you had to have, like a badge you had to wear that like, you're willing to do that. You want to do that for all the musical doors to open, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, you know, but I think then it's very much, you know, I'm the only musical person in my entire family. I think my granddad played the organ, but that's it. So it wasn't mm-hmm. something that anyone really knew how to deal with in my family. And then right. at school, yeah, this was where all the negative, you know.
Do you think that's like more of like a UK mentality, or do you think that was just more unique to your school and your region?
No, I think it's a UK mentality because it was also the same at university. You know, it was, you go and sing, but you do it in a closed room.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's an English thing?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I know that there's an awful lot of great music comes out of
the UK. A crazy amount, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I've always struggled to understand that, to be honest. But I know that going to France and, like I said earlier, collaborating with the painter who was also writing music and poetry, it was just the most fabulous, freeing time ever. I didn't want to leave. This was like a whole new universe
to me,
a whole new way of approaching things. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know why it was seen so negatively.
Yeah, it's a shame. When did you came to Germany in 2010? Okay. And why did you come? Like, because you came from France, right?
No. I worked in a school in the UK for 5 years. Actually, my old school. And they offered me a job. And I worked there for 5 years. And then I came because I met my now ex-husband. You know, did what a lot of people do and moved to a foreign country, left my friends, left my family, mm-hmm. couldn't really speak the language.
You know, that actually, this is good that you brought this up because this is the part of having a guest on that we haven't even touched on yet, which is, you know, half of the show title, which is Immigrant. Tell us about, you know, moving to Germany and, man, dealing with this language, adjusting to the culture. I mean, you seem like someone who's very independent, able to acclimate pretty well, definitely much stronger than I did. But, you know, what you know, things did you face that were really difficult for you? And are there things that you're still adjusting to now?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was sort of floating on a cloud of love when I first arrived. That's since turned into a thundercloud and I landed with my bottom very firmly on the ground. When I first arrived, I wasn't even in Munich itself. I was out in the sticks, in a village between Ismaning and Erding, and everyone spoke Bavarian, and I had a smattering of German. So I'd studied German grammar quite intensively for a year at university, but I had intended to have German and French as my degree subject. After a year of, you know, Guten Tag, wie geht es Ihnen, and all this, they wanted me to read Goethe.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought, nah, no, that, you know, just to barely understand that, I'm going to have to, that's all I'm going to be able to do. My French is just going to hit the floor, you know. So I did another year of sort of the language, and then that was it. And then that would have been 2001, I would have stopped with German. So between then and, so 2001 and 2010, I basically had no German input at all. So I had these sort of vague recollections of the structures, but my vocabulary was nil. And, yeah. And then I end up in deepest, darkest Bavaria.
That must have been so hard to not land in a major city, to be stuck in the villages somewhere.
Yeah, it was. And the family was half Dutch as well. So then I had Dutch to contend with. Bavarian at first, it sounded like someone, sorry to any Bavarians listening. I realized this could be.
It's only a few. Don't worry. If they listen to me, then they accept criticism.
It sounded like someone speaking German with a hot potato in their mouth. And, oh, you are. Well, that's the vision that I had. And I always felt really rotten because I would eventually, my ear would adjust to somebody speaking Bavarian so that I could sort of vaguely understand that what they were saying to me. But then a new person would come along and I would have to readjust for some reason to their way of doing it. And so, you know, these people I meet, they knew I understood a little bit, but when it was them talking, I didn't get a word they were saying, and they felt really offended, as if I was sort of somehow deliberately, you know, snubbing them or whatever. But if it wasn't that, it was just acclimatizing my ear to it. And that's how I got my job at school. I sang an Oktoberfest, a beer hall song in my interview. That's the only reason why I got a job in Germany.
What?
I was asked if I'd acclimatize. Yeah. I was asked, have you acclimatized or have you settled in? And I think I'd been in Germany then for about 4 months, and I'd been to the Erdinger Volksfest, and I'd learned this song about a dead fish. Schau hier, da liegt der tote Fisch im Wasser, den machen wir hier, or whatever, you know. And so in order to show that I'd acclimatized, I sang this song very loudly. And then I got the job. So, yeah, there you go. That's how I got my job. So thanks, Bavaria. Yeah.
So wild.
Yeah, I just.
That's so wild.
Well, I mean, I think I'm a linguist anyway, so I kind of have this expectation of myself.
Sure.
That I'm going to learn it. And also I wanted to know what the kids at school were saying about me behind my back. So I had to kind of learn that. Quite fast. And now, you know, I wouldn't say I can be fluent in some situations, but, you know, I was listening to one of your pod, I think it was the first podcast you did, and you were talking about going to like parties and feeling super left.
Oh, that was the one with Matt Austin, right? From Liverpool.
Right.
No, Manchester.
Yeah,
Manchester.
And I totally empathized with you, because at the beginning I just felt like sitting in a corner and I just didn't really know what to say or do and felt really left out. You know, but you know, gradually I got my German to a decent enough level. I still use DeepL far too much. I feel rather ashamed at how much I use DeepL, but who cares, you know, it's there, I might as well use it.
There's no shame in
but
that.
But I think I also, well, I mean, I also wanted to feel more at home, and, you know, standing at a tram stop and not understanding the billboard, you know, what are they advertising? That just makes you feel so much more alien.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I just wanted to have I wanted to be more tuned into my environment, basically. But I have to say, I got to a certain level, and then I just kind of wing it now.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, you asked me about what I find Did you want to ask me anything more about the language? Or?
Well, I mean, do you still feel like, are you at a point now where you feel comfortable enough that you could, for example, date someone new who doesn't speak English?
Oh, God, yeah.
That's a big step, yeah.
However, if they speak English, I always end up talking to them in English. Just because I feel so much, I can express myself so much more. I don't really feel... I never got on with German as well as I got on with French. You know, French felt more natural. German just doesn't feel, it's not part of me really. It doesn't, even though I actually have my German nationality now, so I probably shouldn't be saying
this. Oh, wow. But that's great. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I wanted to stay in the EU, you know, I didn't want to get chucked out.
So, yeah, there you go.
I wanted
to, that's a whole different struggle there.
But in terms of, what I still find difficult, I think more now it's some attitudes that I struggle with now. Mm-hmm. I find Munich quite conservative and also quite patriarchal as well.
Yeah.
And as a single mother here, I've come up against some real corkers, you know, especially what I call the Oma Polizei. I actually did a song about that. I was invited to do a show called The Fake News with Mel Kelly. I don't know if you know Mel. Mm-hmm. He sort of heads up the Comedy Club Munich, and he asked me to do this fake news show. And I'm not a stand-up comic. And so I had to do a two-minute set. So I wrote a song in German, my God, about the Oma Polizei, who are these sort of old women who lurk in corners of buses and things and pass judgment on your parents.
Yes, they stare. They stare holes through you. Yeah.
Some of the comments that have been made, you know, it's just awful. I've never experienced that anywhere except.
What are some of the things that they've said to you?
I've never experienced it anywhere else. Everyone in the UK just seems to mind. Maybe they just don't care, but they just seem to mind their own business, you know.
What are some of the things they've said to you?
Oh my goodness. I was walking. I was having a really bad day once, and I was walking home with my daughter and looking at a text that my mum had sent me to try and cheer me up. And there was this elderly lady walking the opposite direction to me. And she walked up and as she got to us, she stood stock still and followed us with her eyes. And I'd had enough because I'd had a bad day anyway. And I just said, "Ja, haben Sie ein Problem?" And she just went, "Sie werden ein Problem haben," like implying that, you know, because I, you know, dared to look at my phone for 5 minutes, you know, she just took it completely out of context. Of
course. Oh, wow. She's going to have a problem.
Oh, just really just unpleasant things. Like your daughter looks nothing like you, one old lady said to me, even though she's like a little mirror image of me. Look at your face. Yeah, can you believe it? Your daughter looks nothing like you. I've had that. And a friend of mine was with her daughter at a traffic light, and they were speaking Italian to each other. And the daughter was being a bit cheeky, and my friend was sort of giving her what for. And this old gentleman said, "Lass ihre Tochter sich ausreden, you know, let your daughter say what she has to say." And I just think, you know, sorry, do we know you? Who are you? And why
That's
are you trying to offer me?
Not your business, man.
Absolutely. Just so I find that bizarre. I find that very strange. And I've managed now to sort. I don't think I have really, but I'm trying to let it wash over me or just have a bit of a laugh when I see it. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating. And I do wonder sometimes, would I invite the same comment if I were not female? You know, I don't know. So
I have a hard time believing that we'd get the comments or the looks that we get if we weren't clearly not German.
Maybe.
I don't know. So Emma, I think I have to unfortunately end our call here, but I do want to say, that it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about everything. And I think we could definitely talk for another 2 hours about everything because this was so easy and so relaxed. And, is there anything else, like, is there anything that you want to, say or plug or mention at all to anyone here at the end?
Well, I'm supposed to be doing a improvised musical in I think it's July. I think it's July 17th, although I'd have to go back into my phone and take a look at that, with my friend and the creative director of Bake This. It's called Guilty as Song, and it's going to be at Ganz wo anders, I think, in Munich in July. But whether it'll happen or not, we don't know. And I'm also doing a play, a series of short plays with Entity Theatre, which was supposed to take place last year. And maybe taking place in April this year, although I'm not convinced about that, but it might be taking place later on. It's called Masks and Mirrors. So that's also something else to watch out for on the Entity website.
On which website?
Entity Theatre. So that's not improv, that's straight theater.
Okay. And if people wanted to find out more about shows in the future with Bake This, there's a Facebook page?
There's a website. I think there is a Facebook page, but there's also a website that they can go
okay,
on.
Do you want to send those links? And I can put them in the show notes.
Yeah,
so
sure.
People can, yeah, yeah. So mm-hmm. We're going to have the links that she's mentioned in the show notes on wherever you're listening. So you can take a look and follow Emma on there and her theater ideas and projects and her improv groups. And Emma, this has just been great. And it's been a real pleasure. And we're going to say bye, but then I want to talk to you for just one more minute after we say bye, like on here. Yeah. But thank you guys so much for listening today. And if you want to know more from Emma, like we said, you can go in the show notes and check it out. If you enjoyed today's show, and if you enjoy the show in general, please make sure to go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. And please give us a rating or a review or a comment, because it really helps new listeners find us, like I said at the top. If you'd like to financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/JordanPrince, and all the proceeds will go to our new endeavors with live streaming or with video podcasting. We're going to try and make better and cooler shows this year for you guys. And yes, something I forgot to say at the top that I can say now, I just remembered it, is that if you or someone you know is an artsy-fartsy immigrant and you'd like to contact us, if you have a question for Emma, for example, or you'd like to ask us a question or try and be on the show, you can hit us up on Instagram @artsyfartsyimmigrants, or you can send us a good old-fashioned email to podcast@m945.de. Otherwise, thank you so much, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye. Cool. So, Emma, thank you so much. This was great.
You're welcome. So let's stop recording this now.
Let's stop recording in 3, 2, 1. Look out, baby. The Saints are
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von Jordan Prince und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.